Deep news, reviews, commentary, not just another podcast. Are you on your big ball broadcast?
Wait. Your humble engineer sorta, kinda, maybe forgot to hit record for the first, we'll say, 10 minutes of the show. It's alright though, you didn't miss anything. Just the normal banter, hey Steve, how you doing? Oh, I'm fine, Mark, how are you? Oh, life sucks. So, luckily, I caught on to it very, very quickly. And now I bring you the Big Ball Broadcast already in progress, starting with a comment from our own banhammer wielder, LOL.
Hey guys, it's Queen Law, yay! You're probably discussing this on your show because it's such a trending topic, apparently, but I figured I'd throw in my two cents on the fact that Facebook just updated their layout yet again. Lots of my friends have been complaining about how it looks and how it functions. I personally think it looks great. It's pretty smooth and streamlined. But I take issue with the fact that you could be on the homepage one second and you can see all the recent updates from your friends and whatever the hell they're doing. Then you go anywhere else on Facebook and you come back to the homepage and then it swears that the last thing that anybody did, whether they updated their status or joined a group or whatever, was like freaking 2 hours ago. Like, I'm looking at the homepage right now, and it's doing that very same thing, and I know for a fact that that's not true, because no more than 5 minutes ago, I saw some status updates from friends, and I just don't understand why this is happening, and I really wish it wouldn't. So I'm going to put this message out there, not that anybody from Facebook is listening, because they don't seem to want to listen to the people that use their service. But just like I've been saying about Stickam for months, stop trying to make it look pretty. Start trying to make it functional for everybody, please. Anyway, thanks for having such a great show, guys. And I guess they'll see me in the chat room. Alrighty, bye.
That was a great sound bed, Mark. That made it all worth it.
Yes, uber hyper sexualized Sonic the Hedgehog music.
I was waiting for the guitar with the wah pedal.
Hi everyone, it's Law.
Anyways, onto the topic at hand. Facebook changing their layouts. You know, I don't really mind them doing that because my biggest complaint with MySpace was that the average user could change their layout. And I had to go hit up somebody's MySpace. It took me 45 minutes for all the little animated GIFs and Flash thingies to load. Kyle's like the biggest offender with that. It was like 25 minutes for Kyle's Facebook, MySpace to load. So Facebook really took the bull by the horn and said, no, we're in control of layouts. You can put all the text in the world you want up there, but as far as the formatting, it's going to be uniform across the board. And they're going to keep tweaking that, of course, because they're going, in a lot of cases, on user feedback. You may not like the changes, but when you have, 100 million people using your service, kind of majority rules there. So, I don't know. I like it. I like the new layout. I like the new way it functions. It does seem a lot cleaner, a lot more streamlined. So, I use it as an asset to what I'm doing on other fronts. I have websites, and then I use Facebook for the communication aspect of that website. So, I don't rely entirely on that for my day-to-day. So, whatevers.
Yeah, I haven't really gotten a chance to dig around with the new Facebook layout. And honestly, it doesn't really matter to me. I mean, so long as my news feed is aggregating properly, I really don't care. I really wasn't that big into MySpace customization either. So if they hand me, you can move boxes around and change the layout of your page. And it's just like, you know what? I really don't care. I mean, so long as it does what I need it to do primarily, I don't need it to be as I feel. I don't need it to reflect who I am as a person, like the individual MySpace. It doesn't really matter to me, although I have been seeing periodic posts saying, oh, games don't work anymore, and people joining groups like, change the layout back, and I'm seriously sitting here going, really, do you really care that much? I mean, are you so knee-jerk reaction, fearful of change, that it bothers you so much that the screen got a little bit wider and now, because they didn't really move anything, So the screen got wider and they moved it so you can actually see kind of a short layout of how many friends you have online and crap like that. And they move where your applications are. Oh, dear God.
Yeah, I echo that. You know, as I've talked about previously, I really don't care how your brown cow is doing on Farmville, and I don't care how many points you got in Bejeweled Blitzed. And I just, again, use it a way to stay in touch with people in my network. I think it's incredible in this day and age we can do this. I can remember a time, you know, before the internet, dun, 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 I remember having to call people on the phone and paying long-distance charges. I remember going weeks or months without seeing somebody because I had to wait for a con to come up or whatever and bump into them. So it's an incredible, wonderful thing. And we're also greedy about it. It's like, oh, wait, you're providing this humongous social networking service for free, and you have millions of users, but you're not doing it my way. Come on, what the hell is wrong with you, Facebook?
Yeah, I don't know. Is it supply and demand? Like, we demand that you supply us with a Facebook that you're already giving us for free that we constantly like. It's progress to me. And people like Lol in the chat, she cares. But honestly, I mean, why do people's lives revolve around this dumbass fucking service to the point where if something changes, if one icon changes, they're flipping out? I don't know. I have more important things to worry about, you know, because it's not like it's, you know, Photoshop where, you know, like we moved an entire toolkit from, you know, here to where it's convenient to all the way through five sub menus where it's inconvenient. You know, nothing primary has moved. You can still, you know, everything's at your fingertips on the page, but people are fickle and annoying about this kind of crap.
And again, I don't see why. Everybody has their blog too. Got a bloggity blog, blog this, bloggity blog, blog that. So go over to your Facebook and link to your latest blog entry. Help a brother out. Make it a lot easier. One thing I forgot to mention during the intro is, Mark, you know, one thing you and I have been dealing with this last week, particularly last few days, and I'm sure a lot of people in the chat and listeners to this in post, the snowpocalypse. You know, how have things been on your end over in the Philly area?
We got 70 inches of snow. 70. And here's the engineer's tip of the day. If you have all-speed traction control in your car, it doesn't do jack shit if all four of your wheels are slipping. So turn it off. Because cigarettes are important, and I needed to leave the house. But yeah, last night at about midnight, I was digging my car out and just getting snow out of my driveway. And honestly, I mean, it's meant 2 days off of work, which has made me somewhat stir crazy. But beyond that, I mean, like, it's snow. I really don't care. I prefer the winter to the summer, not for the weather, but for dress codes. I'm sorry. I think that people are classier in the winter. I mean, my wardrobe never changes. It's always a t-shirt, pants, and sneakers. But women.
Yeah, I love the winter too because, you know, the crime rates are drastically reduced because even the junkies don't want to sell a fix on a corner when it's 32 below zero. Yeah, we got some nasty ass snow here yesterday, today. Ended up sliding. Backing out of my driveway last night, being very self-serving, needing cigarettes, I said, you know, it's not too much snow. I can do this. Just backing out of my driveway, my car slid, and I was blocking the entire width of the driveway with my car and just spinning. And I was almost to the point where I was like, fuck it, I'm just going to leave it there. But I was like, no, I'm going to go to work in the morning. Becca's going to go to work and drop Jonathan off. So I made so much noise and commotion. I had neighbors coming at me from all fronts. And after quite the battle, we got my car freed. And yeah, it hasn't been fun going here. I wrote earlier on Facebook, clever tie in there. What the hell's his name now? Chris Sabat talking about, holy shit, 4 inches of snow in Dallas, you know, and it's like the apocalypse. That world is coming to an end. People are buying out the grocery store with perishable goods like eggs and milk and bread. It's ridiculous. And over 4 inches, they're like, oh my god, they probably had like 32 car accidents just in the time since this podcast started.
See, the funny thing is that, you know, that I can forgive, because when you've never seen something, then it obviously becomes, you know, a big deal, like, oh my god, I've never seen a black person. What do you eat? Is it like the stories? Not bitch cast. for you, it's, I would assume that it's worse just because, you know, you're way farther north than me. So, you know, you've got like, as soon as the snow falls, it's probably freaking frozen. But here, I mean, I was just kind of power sliding around the streets having a good time. You know, it doesn't freak me out in the least. And my mom always says, like, oh, you should be careful. You have to be fearful of other drivers. Like, no, other drivers are going at 20 miles an hour. I just avoid them and drive at 50.
Even I know not to do that. You got to have a careful foot. Sometimes it's ridiculous. And yeah, in a lot of cases, it's the other drivers. Where I work at the bottom of a hill, and it snowed last Wednesday. And within a half hour time span, we had four cars up on the front lawn, one almost hitting the house that I work at. So there's a lot of idiots out there. I mean, there's tons of idiots out there. And especially I would think in Texas, you know, you get snow, if people are used to driving in the snow, they're going to hop in their car and still try to do, you know, 65 on the highway. No, you don't do that in the snow. It's not a good idea.
Yeah, it may not be, but I don't really care. I haven't died yet. And that's what matters, because if I die, this show is sunk.
That's a very profound statement. I drive 50 in the snow and I haven't died yet.
It is. You know, I recognize the inevitability of the fact that if I continuously drive at 50 miles an hour during a snowstorm, I'm probably going to lose control of my car and die. But in the meantime, I would just like to get home and not be stuck in traffic for 2 hours.
It's the not dying part that's worse, I think.
If life is that bad, yes.
No, I mean, really, I still have glass in my head from, you know, 2 years ago. It's sometimes like, die. I don't want to go through this.
Yeah, can't you, like, isn't it so exciting that, you know, when you get into your older years in your 50s or 60s, when your skin finally grows underneath the glass, that you're going to be like plucking glass out of your forehead? Doesn't that just make you excited?
Well, it's great because I am glass closer to the surface, so, you know, I'll find glass on my pillow when I wake up in the morning. It's quite the phenomenon. It's pretty messed up.
And, yeah, that's pretty Halloween-y, horror, awful. It's almost Saw-like.
It's just more sad that I have myself to blame on that one. But, you know, rather than go into that, I have a better idea. Why don't we torture you kids with some commercials, and when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about something I found on the internet that I found kind of interesting. That's kind of our shtick here anyway. So stay tuned. Episode 138, resuming shortly.
I am the Original Gamer OG from the Original Gamer Podcast. On my podcast, my crew and I talk about everything gaming related and whether we like it or we think it's crap. We also interview people in the industry, internet celebrities, and professional gamers to get their take on gaming. To listen to the Original Gamer Podcast, you can visit us at original-gamer.com or find us on iTunes under Original Gamer Podcast.
Weebertainment Weekly, the greatest podcast you'll ever find, starring Tombstone and Zach Jenkins.
Sure, there are better ones out there, but not starring them.
This is Tombstone from Weebertainment Weekly, and this is the opportunity for me to shamelessly promote my program.
You mean our program, right?
Yes, Zach Jenkins, I mean our program. You are technically the host.
Since you've taken over being the spokesman for our program, why don't you tell them what we have?
On Weebertainment Weekly, you'll hear the best in entertainment and media news, as well as my favorite section, Talk Nerdy to Me, where I make fun of guys like Zach Jenkins, who wish their girlfriends looked like anime characters.
Your mom. Join us every Tuesday night from 7 to 8 on WeberFM.org, or you can join us on our podcast at WeberTainmentWeekly.blogspot.com or on iTunes under WeberTainment Weekly.
Hey there, hey there, oh there, warning, the following promo may contain some profanity, like fuck, shit, fuck, ass, bitch, and mother. If you're offended by any of the previously mentioned words, well then you're sure not gonna like this next segment.
Yeah, so here's some clips from Deadly Loofa Radio. Enjoy the clusterfuck.
I got 10 purple, and I'd like to advise everyone, they do not taste like purple.
The tire wasn't in the trunk. I was sitting there literally holding the fucking tire.
Oh, they caught him stealing rims.
That's
Ace. Is it working?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that why my crotch is just like hell?
Merry Christmas.
Oh, God.
Wait a minute. So the story just went from you guys in the back of the cop car to Rock's crotch.
Yeah, Rock.
Welcome to DLR.
Well, your mom's going to hear about this later. I am so
Yeah, it's that stupid. Yeah, check us out on iTunes. Just search Deadly Loofa Radio. Or check us out on Stick'em as well. Stick'em.com/Deadly Loofa. We're there, we promise.
It's an honest podcast. I believe when he says, I don't do this because I'm a voice actor, I do this because I'm a fan. But at the same time, acknowledge the fact that there might be a bias there.
It's a knowledgeable podcast.
It wasn't until after Pokemon kind of blew up over here that they actually brought Sailor Moon back for a second round. But I don't think Sailor Moon was ever as popular here the second time around with S and Super S. I don't think it got to the magnitude of popularity that it was here.
It's an opinionated podcast.
I fucking hate this adaptation of Death Note.
It's an emotional podcast.
Yay! No! Okay, it's alright.
It's an odd podcast.
The greatest move ever to destroy the Wandering Warrior was to hit him with a semi.
We're not even joking.
It's an amazing podcast. An amazing podcast every second Wednesday on iTunes and Earth2.net. Earth-2.net.
Those were the beeps. I must be Brett Weaver, and you're listening to the Big Bald Broadcast. Listen to it, love it, know it. Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to the Big Ball Broadcast, episode 138. Other one, Steve and Marksman here. Kyle is unavailable this week, so prepared for whatever. We don't even know what we're going to throw at you. But I need to start off with this, because this is really confusing and confounding, and I may be overlooking something here, so if somebody could help me out with this, I'd really appreciate it. But I was cruising through some of the games coming out this year, and Major League Baseball 2K10 is coming out. A lot of hype about it. Not that I'm necessarily a big sports fan on the consoles, but they're having a promotion going on right now where you can win $1 million, $1 million cash, if you can pitch a no-hitter in this game in Major League Baseball 2K10. So I was reading through a little bit about this promotion they're having, and they're saying it has to be done on the PS3 and the 360, and it has to be done before May 2nd, 2010. So that means, basically, you have to accomplish this task by the end of May 1st, 2010. Here's the part where I'm confused. Underneath the explanation of the contest, they have a nice picture of their box art, and it says, in stores, March 2nd. So you have this promotion to give away $1 million for throwing a no-hitter on the PS3 or 360 version of a game that comes out the day after the contest ends. Help, please.
Wait, is it March or May that it comes out?
March 2nd.
Oh, and it's by May, yeah.
May. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I gotta put the pipe down, is what you're saying. I mean, the drink.
Yes, yeah. Well done. Yeah, I read about that, and I thought that it was kind of an interesting
thing. Cool. I don't know. I mean, I guess on the one hand, you got to hope that you're going to take in, you know, $1 million of disposable income selling this game. That's kind of the inherent risk when you're having a promotion like this. $1 million cash, that's even in this economic downturn, that's nothing to sneeze at. So,
no, and they have like a laundry list of rules. Like, it has to be one continuous video that you're capturing. They're going to look very closely to see if you have rough cuts or edits or, you know, any tricks of the eye or any, you know.
And like, it has to be online too, because I'm sure they're going to be able to go ahead and verify that online activity as well.
Yep. But unfortunately, that's just one thing where it's like, yeah, I suck at sports games, so I can't really even take a crack at that without making a fool of myself. Now, if they want, you know, like highest hit combo and Bayonetta for the United States, because you can't include Japan because they're totally freaks. But yeah, like highest hit combo and Bayonetta, $1 million. Like, all right, I'll take a crack at that.
Well, I mean, do you think this will become a trend? Not necessarily, you know, $1 million, but do you think it would be a trend with developers to, you know, give people even more incentive than they already do to play their games? I read a really interesting article a couple of years ago about how gamers are actually complaining there's too many good games on the market. And it's a plea to developers saying, can you release a good game maybe once a year, every other year? Because everybody's really releasing these great games and they're all coming out simultaneously. And the lashback with that is people aren't playing these great games. You have to pass them over. You know, Call of Duty 4 comes out, and then Left 4 Dead 2 comes out, so you drop in Call of Duty to pick up Left 4 Dead, and then, oh my god, then Bayonetta comes out, and now God of War 3 is coming out. It was an interesting take on what's going on in the gamer market. The game market is truly recession-proof. Again, with the current economic situation, you have the best games hitting the market right now. It's ridiculous. But back to being on topic, I wonder if you'll see developers start putting these incentives in instead of having DLC saying, you know, first person to, I don't know, like you said, Mark, you get X number combo in this game and you get something from the developer.
I see screw the complainers in terms of that. Like, oh, there's too many good games coming out at the same time. Yeah, but that's good. I just finished Dead Space Extraction, which was voted GameSpot's best game you've never played on the Wii. And it really was the best game that I hadn't previously played on the Wii. Like, it made me take back some of the things that I think about Wii and rail shooters.
I think the biggest issue is not everybody can afford just to go out and pick up all these games. You talk about the Wii, and it's kind of funny. You, I think, have been spending more time playing Wii than anything else these days. You were playing Red Dead. No. What were you playing?
I was playing House of the Dead Overkill.
House of the Dead, that's it.
But that was only for like one day because I was really, really immersed in Dead Space Extraction. And before then, like, that, you know, it was No More Heroes.
Tatsunoko versus Capcom came out. And now,
oh yeah, and I had to beat that game into the ground because Mars Girl was just making fun of me because I just could not get the swing of the game because I was trying to play it like Marvel versus Capcom 2, and I was like, this game is awful. And she's like, oh, it's not awful, you're just awful at it. I'm like, oh, give me your friend code. Give me your friend code, I'm going to lay the smack down on you. But I finally...
Did you ever think you'd see the day where you had must-haves on all three consoles across the board?
See, I don't know what you would call a must-have, because I went and I got Darksiders. I bought that off my friend because he couldn't stand it. And that game was just a composite game. It was, you know, the gameplay elements of God of War and Castlevania and Portal, and the story was really good. It was really engaging, and the acting was great, and Liam O'Brien, you know, decided to deadpan it out of the park, which is what he's really, really good at. And him playing across Hamill was really, really good, so the story of that game was great. I wouldn't call the game a must-have.
But I mean, all right, by the reason of IGN anyway, Bayonetta was a must-have. You and I know, both beat that game into the ground. In hindsight, do you consider it a must-have? Was it a worthy 9.6 from IGN?
I don't know. I'm very much in line with Adam Sessler's theory as to what does 9.6 versus 9.5 versus 9 mean in the grand scheme of everything. Like, how can you justify to me 0.1% more in a gamer score? I think it was a high-tier game. I think it was worth, you know, what XPlay would call a 4 out of 5. But It was a must have. I mean, I'm a fan of Devil May Cry, so I really did want to see what that game turned into, and I had a really, really good time. Now, am I complaining about the fact that all these good games are coming out at the same time, like BioShock 2 and Mass Effect? No, because I mean, the games will still be on the shelves a month from now, 3 months from now.
Yeah, but what's going to be out 3 months from now? You know, I can see the conundrum side of it. Again, I don't have the disposable income to go pick up 2-3 games a month. I bitched about having to go pick up 8-9 titles when I was collecting comic books, you know. And some of these games take a while to play, especially if you're talking about these online games. A lot of the shooters, you know, it's a big time suck. So as that's happening and all these other games are coming up, I mean, you're not a gamer unless you're playing these games. It's got to be tough, you know. How do you pick up, you know, in some cases, 5 games in a month because all these incredible titles are coming out and you want to keep on top of the trend while it's hip and happening. You know, why pick it up later?
See, that's where the pin is. That's where the linchpin is if you're trying to keep up. I mean, if you're having constant conversations, or let's say you're doing a topical podcast that happens to be on Thick Cam on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 Pacific, then yeah, it behooves you to try and, you know, keep on top of games. But if that has nothing to do, like if there's no pressing issue, you know, if there's nothing that's pressing you to have all those games now, and play them all now, then, you know, either buy them in a truncated stint, you know, buy a game a month, 2 games a month. I mean, I'm still sitting on No More Heroes 1 in Mad World, and I'm not opening Mad World until I finish No More Heroes, at which point I'm still not opening Mad World because I need to buy No More Heroes 2.
And when is Street Fighter 4 coming out?
Yeah, but see, that's kind of like, oh, we'll just pick up and play. You know, it doesn't really matter because you're not doing it like, oh, God, I need to know what happens in Street Fighter.
No, you but know, for those playing online, you got to kind of strike while the iron's hot. You know, you want to.
Yeah, for the leader, for the sake of the leaderboards, yeah. Yes.
And, you know, you put Street Fighter 4 in front of me and you put God of War 3 in front of me, that's being torn. That's cruel and unusual punishment.
Oh, come on, dude. That's no contest for you.
No. No, for me personally. No. For other gamers, though, it could be a problem.
I'm wondering if the persons in the chat when I posted on Facebook that on March whatever, God of War 3 drops and we'll and Steve will have suddenly fallen ill. I wonder if they're in the chat because whoever it was that said that you would have contracted Kratosis.
I like that.
They should get a medal for that.
Because that's what it'll be. It'll be a full-blown case of Kratosis. Probably means me incapacitated from the podcast, probably 2 episodes. Definitely 1, maybe 2.
Yeah, and I don't harsh you for that at all, because I'm going to be the same way. There might not even be a podcast when God of War 3 comes out.
Kyle will be around.
Here like, yeah. You guys want to do a show? Like, dude, we're totally freaking playing God of War right now. Shut up. Go away. Go get a life.
I know. He's like, with Bayonetta, I did a podcast kind of playing a little Bayonetta. Did a bitch cast playing Bayonetta. God of War. There's no like casting and playing God of War. That's not happening.
Yeah, there's you're just too distracted at that point because, I mean, God of War is far more visceral a game than Bayonetta was. Like, we've been going like, oh, yeah, hey, Steve, what do you think about that? Huh? What?
Yeah.
Combo? Arm is played? All right, so how about a story? Tell me a story, Steve.
All right. I get to read words on a page. Magic Jack making cell phone fees disappear. The company behind the Magic Jack, the cheap internet phone gadget, has been heavily promoted on TV and now has a new version of the device that allows for free calls from cell phones in the home in a fashion that's sure to draw protests from cellular carriers. The new Magic Jack uses, without permission, radio frequencies, which cellular carriers have paid billions of dollars for exclusive license. WiMAX Corp., which is based in Palm Beach, Florida, said that the International Consumer Electronics Show that it plans to start selling the device in about 4 months for $40, the same price as the original Magic Deck. As before, it will provide free calls to the U.S. and Canada for 1 year. The device, in essence, is a very small cellular tower for your home. The size of a deck of cards, it plugs into a PC which needs a broadband internet connection. The device then detects when a compatible cell phone comes within 8 feet and then places a call to it. The user enters a short code on the phone. The phone is then linked to the Magic Jack, and as long as it is within the range, and WiMAX says it will cover about a 3,000 square foot home, Magic Jack routes the call itself over the internet rather than going through the carrier's cellular tower. No minutes or subtractions from the user's account with the carrier. Any extra fees for international calls are subtracted from the user's account with Magic Jack, not the carrier. So rather than go on, of course, it's a huge legal issue. AT&T, T-Mobile, and the Federal Communications Commission had no immediate comment, but they are basically just waiting to see them, you know, make that first move of putting things in the market. And a banhammer bigger than laws is going to come down on these people because you can't take those radio frequencies. You know, the FCC establishes certain frequencies within certain bandwidth ranges to companies, and they get to use those exclusively for a lot of money. And when somebody tries to cut in on that business, I don't think you're going to own one anytime soon, even if you really did want one.
This is, you know, yet another, hey, how can we get around paying a phone bill type of thing? I mean, we're doing this podcast over Skype, which, you know, is ostensibly free until you want to make phone calls to, you know, an actual terrestrial phone. But even then, the cost of a Skype phone number is extremely cheap, $2.99 a month for domestic calls. So I heard about this Magic Jack thing and I just kind of said, you know, it's kind of cute, kind of kooky, but is it really going to work? I mean, especially if the FCC declines comment right now, you know that, yeah, they are going to drop something on them and they're going to drop it hard and heavy and fast. But at the same time, I mean, isn't this part of the point as to why it is that we went digital with, you know, over-the-air television so that way they could start experimenting with all this white space and what can we do with it and how much can we pump through ethereal bandwidth? So if Magic Jack as a company came up with, you know, a kind of cost-effective way to get this down and cheaper, then I don't really think that they should be penalized for the fact it's like, oh, nope, we did it better than you. Sorry. I mean, the technology exists where it's like, we don't even have to hand out handsets. Every 2 out of 3 phones uses, you know, can dump to a Wi-Fi connection if there's no signal. So, you know, other than the fucking G1. My only complaint about that phone. But yeah,
I think the big issue that I neglected to mention is how often are you really using your cell phone at home? That's great if you're a talkaholic in the comfort of your own domain, but your cell phone is it's a portable device. You use it throughout the day. I don't think any money you're saving is going to be significant if you can only use it at home. Unless you plug it into your laptop and you just get it with you wherever you go. But using it strictly as a home device, even a 3,000 square foot home, it's only going to knock a little bit off your phone bill. You're probably more inclined to use it during the day while you're out driving or, you know, back and forth to work or whatever.
Yeah, but how much time do you spend at home? I mean, I'm at work for 8 hours a day. So are you, more than 8 hours. So you're pretty much solely reliant on your cell phone. And if you lost phone service, you know, terrestrial phone service in your house, would you really notice? You know, if your phone just stopped ringing, like just instantaneously, if your wife just canceled the phone service, would you really notice? Do more people call your cell phone or do they call your house phone?
I don't have a house phone.
Ah.
And there hasn't been a need for us to have a house phone. We ditched our home phone probably about a year ago because there was redundancy built into the process. So we dropped a bill. So, and a lot of people that go in that route, they really aren't going to be terrestrial lines in the near future, in our foreseeable future, definitely within our lifetime. There will be no more terrestrial lines. You won't see telephone poles anymore. They'll be non-existent. Think of the past.
Well, why not? I mean, they're irradiated anyway, sort of. I mean, if we can get rid of power lines, if we can get rid of phone lines, that'll be kind of cool just because it'll be far fewer people getting brain tumors from living so near them.
Well, we'll always do the power lines because we're going to power our devices somehow.
Well, contrary to Tesla's belief, I mean, there's a lot of experiments going on with the whole ethereal power line idea, where it's essentially like, no, let's just pump power through the ground. Why not? I mean, sure, it'll wreck the earth a little bit more, but hey, people won't get cancer.
And it won't affect my generation, so what do I care?
Exactly. Like, oh, this is such a green technology. 50 years from now, grass won't grow anymore.
What's grass?
What is this mystical grass you speak of? See, now if it did affect your generation, what if it only took 10 years for it to ruin the soil of the earth all over, and then, you know, certain unmentionables stop growing properly,
or in some cases already have. Mark, take us somewhere else.
Taking the return of Snake Plissken, not Solid Snake. Solid Snake Plissken Snake. What? No, Snake Plissken heads back into New York prison. Escape from New York again is back in play. Why? Because the studios found someone who can allegedly write witty Snake Plissken banner without making it sound campy. An impossible task, maybe, but nevertheless, they're going to go through with it. New Line Cinema has hired Alan Loeb, 21, and Wall Street 2 to write the new Escape to New York reboot. And according to New York Magazine sources, script's dialogue doesn't stink of campiness and overwrought dialogue. Loeb has reportedly changed Plissken's mission from saving the president, who's crash-landed in the middle of future Manhattan, now a giant prison, to rescuing a female senator. Who wants to bet she's a feisty, take-charge lady with a kick-ass body to match? Oh god, it's gonna be Megan Fox. The biggest issue for this film, according to the New York Mag, wasn't just the banter, but the location. It's expensive to turn Manhattan into a giant futuristic prison, but it sounds like the studio figured out a plan. In the original, set at the end of World War III, New York City was a husk of itself after being turned into a giant prison, but that kind of destruction gets pricey, so in Escape 2.0, the Big Apple that as yet uncast Snake Plissken is dropped into will be geographically undesirable, but intact. This Manhattan was evacuated and turned into a privately run penal colony after the detonation of a crude radioactive dirty bomb on the outskirts of the city. It's not a disaster movie, says a source close to the project. It is an expose of an ecosystem. If you put a huge well around Manhattan and drop the most fucked up dangerous criminals on Earth. This means that now New York will still be recognizable to audiences, a la I Am Legend, rather than an entirely new Armageddon Island.
I'm just hanging my head in shame here because
me too.
I went off this massive tirade before we started recording about how I grew up with Escape from New York. Oh my God, I was coming into my adolescence, and that was a coming into adolescence film. It was Snake Badass Plissken, Kurt Russell at his best. Yeah, it was campy. It was even campy for its time, but that was part of its appeal. And you already had the feisty female in there. You know, it made it a much more believable aspect of the relationships going on within the film. I like the weight, the pressingness of the original Escape from New York because it was about saving the president. Air Force One went down on Manhattan, which was a penal colony. So it's far more important than, you know, a chick senator. Like, fuck it. All right, she's gone. All right, we're going to hold elections for her seat. No big deal. You just don't feel that type of weight behind it. And without Kurt Russell, I'm already saying no.
Well, I'm not opposed to a reboot of Escape just because, you know, I mean, it potentially has the ability to be really good. I mean, if they tried to hand me an Evil Dead reboot, so long as they handed me someone who looks like Bruce Campbell, which, I mean, there were two actors under Joss Whedon who really could have filled the roles of Ash really well, I would have, you know, given it a shot. The idea that they're turning it into a female senator, you're right. It really is kind of an idea of like, oh, the senator's so important. Well, why? It's a senator. It's not the freaking president. It's not, you know, the commander in chief, your figurehead for all of your dirty operations that you need to put a smile on. Why would you send someone in for that? I mean, I guess if they kind of treated Plissken like, well, you know, you're on death row anyway, but if you happen to save us the time and trouble and money of having to run an election, we'll let you go. But that's not how they're going to spin it. You know that's not how they're going to spin it. So, I mean, what's really the point in making such stark changes? I mean, okay, yeah, turning New York into not post-apocalyptic penal colony thing is costly. But, I mean, if you're going to make all these kind of quick cuts and edits and turns and changes, then what's the point in having the reboot in the first place?
And that's kind of my issue with reboots in general. If a good movie was made, like Escape from New York, then watch Escape from New York. If you want to introduce your kids to it, have them watch Escape from New York with Kurt Russell. There's no need to keep rebooting these franchises. They're rebooting, relaunching, obviously, franchises that had appeal, because otherwise you wouldn't sink the money behind it. So if they originally had that appeal, yeah, some of it's dated, but a lot of that charm, a lot of that appeal is because it's dated. What's next? You know, are they going to reboot Back to the Future? How are you going to react to that? That was a huge film for your generation. Are you going to sit back, you know, very coyfully and go, you know, I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to go in this open-minded. Or are you going to say, fuck no. This is Back to the Future. That movie was badass. Why would you touch that?
Yeah, it's kind of like when they tried to reboot Knight Rider, and since Universal had overall deals with Ford Motors, that they had to change Kit from a Trans Am to a Mustang. Yeah, it's about the same thing.
So, yeah, you know, I can call shenanigans on it because I'm old and pissy. But you watch, young whippersnappers. Your day will come. Your Harry Potters and your Narnias and your whatever else. This is all going to be facing the reboot gods. I want to see if you'd take that with a smile on your face as you bend over. And don't even pay $4.95 because ticket prices are more like $12.95.
Yeah, and it is getting pretty ridiculous. I mean, it's why it is that I'm very accepting of comic book movies. It's because, you know, you get comic book movies and you get rehashed stories over and over and over again. And then you get reboots too. So I get my rehashed love story, I get my new comic book story, and I get some random reboot of a franchise from the 80s. I'll always take the comic book movie over those other two because at least I know that it might be derivative of some other story, but at least, you know, you put the paint, the really good paint job of, oh, it's superheroes, it's capes, you know.
What scares me about that is we have a story coming up about our good friend Chris Nolan, who called up and gave us an inside scoop. But another thing Nolan's responsible for, he's sitting on the DC board, he's also overlooking the Superman reboot. And that's really scary, you know, because of his involvement in the first two Batman relaunches where, you know, we talked about the dark and gritty. It really sold. It really banked. So now you're going to have him looking at Superman quite possibly with, got to bring him very dark and gritty and dirty. And that scares me for superhero films. On the other side of the spectrum, the movie I'm most excited for this year is definitely Kick-Ass. I think Kick-Ass is going to do just that. He has this fairly indie film shot on the cheap. It's got Nick Cage, super campy Nick Cage, and it's acceptable in this role. An 11-year-old that decapitates and dismembers people, so you really can't go wrong with that.
Dovetailing off of Wanted, I think that's going to be freaking awesome.
But I'm almost afraid that Hollywood's going to say, wow, here's a superhero film that was shot in the cheap and was very tongue-in-cheek, campy, and became very, very successful, because I do foresee that for this film. It's going to be a very talked-about film. I'm almost afraid that they're going to take that approach. I don't think there's going to be a happy medium in the genre, because the genre is so wide, because it can go from slapstick to extremely over-the-edge serious, you know, like Watchmen. So there's never going to be a formula to superhero films, and you're going to have to kind of always go in with your fingers crossed saying, I hope this was worth it. I hope it was worth going into this one, because we have a lot coming out in the next 3 years.
Yeah, including Deadpool. Dear God. All right, Steve, take us somewhere.
This story is actually pretty funny. We're going to talk about this on last week's podcast, but we didn't have time. Upper Deck made bootleg Yu-Gi-Oh cards. Now, if your mind isn't blown yet, it's going to be real soon. Let me explain this. When the Yu-Gi-Oh! Trading card game first came to America, it was Upper Deck who made the cards. They had the license for 6 years. Upper Deck has been respected as a popular trading card company for 20 years, making all manners of professional sports cards, trading card games like Marvel vs. and the World of Warcraft card game. In 2008, Konami, the owners of the Yu-Gi-Oh! Game, who gave the license to Upper Deck, found some bootlegged Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards distributed by a company called Vintage Sports Cards. Vintage Sports Cards said they got the counterfeit cards from Upper Deck, and they proved they did. So last week, a court found Upper Deck liable for counterfeiting and trademark infringement, which means Upper Deck was selling bootleg Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards when they had the license to make Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards legally, and they were the only ones in North America producing them. And if that's not the craziest shit you ever heard, then I don't know. I mean, honestly, the only sellers or anything I could think of are drug dealers who cut flour in with their cocaine and nonsense like that. And Hasbro doesn't make some super crazy Spider-Man bootlegs that you see in shady mall kiosks, because it doesn't make any sense. So, I don't know. This is like super confounding about why the company who had the license and was legally making Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards was making counterfeit Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards on the side and selling those to other distributors.
Wow. Now, the last time I remember counterfeit cards in terms of Yu-Gi-Oh! Was the Egyptian God cards, because everybody needed to have them as they were touching on them in the series, but they weren't available in the States yet, and kids would get in a freaking fist fights over the fact that, like, you can't use a Japanese God card, you can't even read what it says! Yeah, that's kind of funny. Like, I don't know, that's almost like a black op to make other people look bad, and it just went south, and, you know, the truth came out, like, we got them from Upper Deck! I don't know,
lost lawsuit. That's like the thing that brings the smile to your face. It's like, wow, you guys are stupid, and now you're really going to pay for it.
Like seriously, you had the golden ticket. You had the keys to the freaking kingdom. You had the longest running, you know, or one of the longest running battle anime card sets to license, and you still bootlegged them out. It's like,
could you imagine going to your local flea market and picking up, you know, the entire Dragon Ball Z series on DVD for $50, and it's these horrible bootlegs with paper labels and markers written on them. And then it's, you know, Lance from Funimation sitting behind the table selling them to you. It doesn't make any sense at all. You're the licensee. You
or like Funimation selling quote-unquote Dragon Ball AF movies.
Right. We have the license. We can do this.
We can totally just make this up on the fly, just like crappy Flash cartoon. Just, you know, done something done left-handed by Kerberfer because, you know, someone asked him to.
But, you know, if it's them doing it, you would assume they wouldn't look like shitty, flimsy reproductions. You know, they're probably all foil stamped and everything. Just the effort, the time, the money behind that. make some more Blue Eyes White Dragon or whatever cards. Yeah,
you wonder, like, is the art original art, or did they just rip art from other cards? Because sometimes the Japanese and the American art looks different between the cards. So I wonder what these cards look like. And
I don't think they would be common cards. You probably wouldn't fake commons. You're probably faking, you know, super uber powerful cards. That's my assumption. If you're faking commons, then you got bigger issues than
anybody. Yeah, you have no scruples at that point. It's like, here's my Dark Magician. It's like, what? Did you seriously just spend like $50,000 making a bunch of Dark Magician knockoffs? What the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah, it would have to be some pretty premium content. But even at that rate, do it as Upper Deck. What the hell?
Whatever, I guess. I don't know. In order to take us from from what it has to be, the funniest thing I've heard all week, Chris Nolan, not only the godfather of the new Superman reboot, but is also confirmed for his third Batman film, which we're all wondering where this is going to go. Buried in an interview with Warner Brothers president Jeff Robinoff are two very exciting movie announcements. The next Dark Knight is a go, and the Wonder Woman movie might be in the works. Just take a minute and let that process. Hey, Joss, what are you up to? Anyway. Yesterday's rumors were circulating that the third Nolan Batman film was in the works with brother Jonah and David Goyer on the board to co-write the script. And now the New York Times has confirmed the Batman film and possibly Wonder Woman as a movie. While interviewing director Nolan about working with Robinoff, they confirmed the next Batman picture and later let it slide that Wonder Woman might also be the next DC character that they focus on. He's trying not to cling to things that have worked in the past, said Chris Nolan, who directed The Dark Knight, and is working on another Batman sequel. The Walt Disney Company's $4 billion purchase of Marvel Entertainment just over a month ago has increased pressure on Warner to succeed this time. Warner is expected to announce a DC slate in the upcoming months, populated by characters like The Flash and Wonder Woman, which are promises that we've heard for years now. So honestly, I really don't know why this is such a big deal. I mean, yes, a third Batman film is a really big deal. That's really freaking awesome. But The Flash, well, Ryan Reynolds already got pimped out to do Green Lantern, which is terrible because everybody wanted Ryan Reynolds to be The Flash. And Wonder Woman, well, Joss Whedon's crying in a corner somewhere. So if he couldn't do it, the person that was essentially writing a Vampire Slayer ripoff of Wonder Woman for so long, I wonder who could.
DC, I think, is just kind of making this up as they go because they're looking at Marvel. He just got acquired by Disney for $4 billion. That's a lot of money to bankroll shit coming up the pike. You got powerful franchises that are guaranteed to make money regardless. You got a Spider-Man reboot that's coming out, I think it's 2012 now, July of 2012. And it's going to be huge. Whether you love it or hate it, it's going to be huge box office dollars. You have the Avengers, you have Captain America, you have Iron Man 2. It's just this incredible slate that just says bank written all over it. What does DC have? The Flash, Wonder Woman. I laugh every time I hear Wonder Woman for one reason and one reason only. We're not living in that day and age anymore. Women are not subservient S&M objects for men anymore. That's what Wonder Woman started off as, kids. You know, don't tell me a word for it. Google it. It was all S&M bondage, and it was very, very, very sexual. And it's the only reason the boys were picking it up. She doesn't have a tremendous rogues gallery. Who is her, you know, big enemy going to be in this film? I kind of have a...
Hold on. I can answer that.
Ares! Well, you know, I had that problem, the same problem with the standalone Thor movie, and Marvel's already greenlit that, and it's like, until he comes into continuity with the rest of the Marvel Universe with the Avengers film, I'm really not too big on that historic, you know, epic. I'm thinking it's kind of going to look like Clash of the Titans. It's not going to bring anything new. And it's going to be hard to look at as a superhero film, I think. It's going to look more like 300 than... The Dark Knight. So, Wonder Woman, if you're into that type of sexual exploitation of women, go see it. You know, if you have any common sense of morals, avoid it.
Well, Wonder Woman I'd be on board with just because I watched the new Wonder Woman animated, and it had a good cast of characters, and it had Nathan Fillion in it, for Christ's sake. And if they get Nathan Fillion to be Steve Trevor, then that would be kind of cool. That would be kind of a throw up to the Firefly fans, and that would also be kind of a throw up to, like, haha, Joss didn't write it. Because I just love making fun of him, because I was listening to the episode where I essentially said, like, Joss just can't help but say stupid, stupid things. But yeah, I mean, in terms of DC, it really is just, you know, you have Justice League, and in the Justice League, only half of them matter in terms of the primaries. So you have Batman, Superman. That's pretty much it. Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, technically. And then you have Flash, Green Lantern, Martian Manhunter, which, you know, no one really cares too much about them. I mean, people are going to pile into theaters to see a Green Lantern film, I hope. In a perfect world, they would. But, I mean, it really is, you know, Marvel has ridiculous amount of characters to the point where, you know, they had to have an entire event just to kill off three quarters of them. Because that's just too many people running around with superpowers. While DC, and I mean, they have a lot of characters, but they're obscure. They don't read very well to a person that's just kind of picking them up. You know, their character histories and powers are very more deeply rooted. So DC characters, although better written in my opinion, are less accessible than Marvel characters. So Marvel kind of has the upper hand in terms of, like, yeah, we can just pump out movies all day. Deadpool, we only need one movie to introduce him. So, yeah.
I do almost laugh at the thought of a Captain America standalone film coming out. I think it probably would have been more wise for Marvel just to do this little lead off, this little flashback maybe, of what happened to Captain America back after World War II. Then start him off in the current continuity, because doing a standalone piece on Captain America isn't going to fly well with the rest of the world. You know, even if it's a box office smash here, I don't think it's going to do too well here. I mean, G.I. Joe got renamed for a lot of other countries to get rid of the real American hero aspect of it and just have them a multinational conglomerate.
In the first Street Fighter movie, despite the fact that Ryu and Ken are the main characters in the game, they made Guile the main character in that movie.
And with Captain America, it's just really hard to disguise that fact when the guy's basically running around draped in an American flag. So,
yeah, he's Captain Red, White, and Blue, having nothing to do with the United States of Oppression. Anyway.
No. How's this flick going to fly in the Middle East? Or three quarters of the world, for that matter.
Yeah, really. Like, short of, like, throwing Obama in a Cap movie, it's just not going to fly outside of the domestic returns.
But, you know, Avengers, we keep hearing that. Avengers is going to be huge. It's going to be the first time in a comic book brought to the big screen where you see a huge franchise crossover. And everybody's been talking about it for a long time, waiting for all these characters to get together. DC has so many problems. I don't think you're going to see a Justice League movie in the near future. Again, that's the beauty with Marvel. Everything's under one house. Everything's under the House of Mouse. And the House of Mouse has plenty of money to piss away on these silly comic book movies, knowing they're going to make tenfold on their investment. DC, they're so scattered, so fractured, that just to get everything back on track where you could even use your flagship character, Superman, because of what's going on with the Siegel and Schuster stuff. Yeah, why don't you clear that up first, and 20 years from now we'll talk about a Justice League flick.
Report. Menace to Society directors to helm Akira flick, or Akira, depending on whether or not you're a commie. The Hughes brothers, best known for their urban crime drama Menace to Society, and more recently The Book of Eli, will be bringing the cyberpunk Akira manga to the silver screen. I keep wanting to say Akira. I do. Says New York Magazine. The screen will be penned by Iron Man writers Mark Fergus and Hawk Otsby. And produced by Leonardo DiCaprio. Instead of trying to cram all 2,000 plus pages of the Akira manga epic into 2 hours, Warner Brothers is planning on releasing the film into two parts. Each part would cover three volumes of the manga. Not entirely convinced the world needs a Hollywood adaptation of this movie. The Hughes brothers could be a good choice. Menace to Society was solid and Book of Eli looks cool. Too bad Dead Presidents and From Hell were crap. Every time we keep getting back to Akira news, I'm just like, who cares? I mean, really, it's good as animation. It's great as animation. You know, you can just digitally remaster the film every year. I don't care if you redo the whole film. Just don't give it to me in live action. It's not gonna play, and it's most certainly not going to cause a riot amongst anime fans when they see that it's not Tokyo, but it's Neo New York.
I'm hoping that's changed. I'm hoping this thing's been through numerous rewrites. I'm hoping that's why we're hearing news about a film now instead of when they first started talking about this a couple years ago. I hope it's because they had some time to reflect and said, you know, for a lot of people, myself included, that was my gateway drug. I mean, yeah, I was watching anime very young. I was watching a lot of the stuff they butchered for the U.S. audience, like G-Force and Voltron. I was watching that stuff as a kid, and I loved it, but I never knew, you know, there was no difference to me between watching that or Warner Brothers cartoons. It was a cartoon. Akira, and I will call it Akira because my addiction came from watching that first generation VHS movie when it first came out with, you know, Bob Bergen in it. It was Akira, and there was something different about it. It wasn't Ultraman, you know, it wasn't G-Force, it wasn't anything like that. I mean, there was blood and there was boobies and there was alcohol and drugs and just really, really warped concepts. That blew my mind, you know, in late adolescence when I first got my hands on this. And that's like, wow, there's something like really deep going on in the anime industry, and it's not domestic. And it made me start turning my eyes to the East. What else do you have? You know, it was Dragon Ball after that, and it just, you know, really compounded from there. This movie's big. It's big. Even if you didn't like the animated movie, the manga was huge. I mean, how long was that thing reprinted? I think every publisher on the planet had a shot at releasing that thing at one form or another. So it's a really, really big deal. And if it's done right, it has the potential to be successful. But you look at some of these big name properties, the first thing that pops in my head is Dragon Ball, and look how atrocious that movie was. I don't know if the studios that are picking up these properties can really equate to the fan base, the sincerity of the fan base for those properties, or they're just picking up for the sake of them like being big name franchises. This is something that really has to be handled with kid gloves. It's something that has to be very sensitively done. This isn't the type of movie you go into and say, I'm going to bring my own artistic spin to this. You can't do that. Look what happened to Speed Racer, you know? It's fail. And it either has to be incredibly epic or don't do it. There's no middle ground when you start talking about Akira.
Yeah, I don't know, because for me it's not as integral to my anime watching, because for you it's Akira, but for me it's Tenchi. So if they were trying to take a crack at Tenchi, I would be immensely pissed, because it would play exactly like Dragon Ball Evolution. You know, it's like, where's Ryoko? Oh, it's that brown haired chick with the blue highlights. Like, ugh. So I just don't care about it in the sense where, you know, I know it's going to start trouble. I know it's going to completely light the fan base on fire, and I just don't feel any which way about it. But if it were Tenchi, that's where it is that I can empathize. Like, I know that I would feel the exact same way about Tenchi if they tried to take a crack at that.
And what's pretty sad is that it's kind of win-win for Hollywood, because, you know, with the exception of Dragon Ball Evolution, because that was just a poorly made film. It wasn't that it was a poor adaptation. It was a poor film. I don't care what characters and scenarios you gave this crew to produce. It was going to be a miserable abomination. And it's ripping on this so much, I forgot what I was going to say. all right, go on, Mark. If I think of it, if it comes back, I'll interrupt you again.
Well,
I wanted to comment on that. And the thought escaped me. Because in my mind, anyway, it was pretty good. It was a pretty good retort. Like, hey, blah, blah, blah. And you'd say, blah, blah, blah. But that's not going to happen, apparently.
Well, now you can have, like, the eureka moment where you can just, like, I wouldn't mind it if you just came back and go, like, it was this thing! Okay.
All Doc Brown style.
Great Scott!
I just might. So let's hold some hope for that. But, this is pretty interesting. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'll use the very carefully chosen word interesting. And it goes, we were talking about earlier with Facebook. Google now up on the whole social buzz thing going on, literally Google Buzz. I haven't really been following the story, and I'm a big Gmail user. Every single one of my email accounts I have, I all redirect to my one primary Gmail account, and I use it for everything. And I went to go check my Gmail today, and I saw this colorful icon underneath my inbox. And what's this? And I clicked on it, and I saw something that looked like a poor man's Facebook. That's the only way I can really put it. I talked about earlier how, you know, Facebook's very uniform across the users. It's very simplified. Imagine, if you will, stripping that down even further to its most basic of essentials and calling that social media. And that's what my first look upon Google Buzz was way too little. I understand the whole minimal push nowadays, but way too minimal and way too late. Google should have been eyeing social media back in the MySpace heydays, because God knows anything Google does is in beta for 6 years before it's out, you know, full to the public. But they waited so long, and Facebook got so big, and people had this huge mass migration from MySpace. And, you know, a year and a half later, Google's like, well, we're going to throw our hat in the arena. I understand why. I understand you have millions of people using Gmail, and you're integrating it right into the Gmail. You don't have to go to an external site and sign in with a different username or password. You're going to the same place you go probably, you know, 15 times a day, and you're hooked up to your social media. In theory, sounds great. In practice, everybody's so far entrenched in Facebook right now, you don't need a new form of media to have all these communications. It starts becoming just social network overkill for me anyway. I can't maintain friends and comments and blah, blah, blah across two networks. I'll continue to ride that Facebook wave. Thank you very much, Google. Love your email service. Glad to see your stocks are climbing up again, but I just don't need this.
Well, I mean, how far distilled do our social networks need to be? Where, you know, there's a million different aggregation distillers for Twitter, and now there's, you know, now there's Google Buzz, and, you know, like, my central aggregator for all of my social networks is my fucking computer, all right? Like, I have a choice to have it, you know, pushed to my phone or pushed through AIM or whatever, but, I mean, my central aggregator is my computer itself. I don't mind clicking an extra button or two just to go directly to Facebook, or previously directly to MySpace, or, you know, to go to Twitter to check the BBB Twitter. Like, I don't need this. And I haven't even looked at Google Buzz yet. And I understand that, you know, they want to have kind of their overlooming shadow over everything, because they're not going to interfere with Facebook, but they're just going to say, it's like, you know, you don't need to go to Facebook or MySpace or Twitter. You could just have it all aggregating right here, right now. But, I mean, what's really the point? I mean, how finely concentrated does all of this stuff need to be?
I guess it depends on who you are.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kyle will love it.
See, now I'm going to feel horrible for what I'm about to say, because you prefaced it with that. But I don't mean this at Kyle. But I think the more you care about it, the less productive in society you are. You know, people live in their lives minute to minute through Facebook and stuff. And it's like, don't you, like, work or have a family and friends and actually do physical activities, you know, or is your life just live vicariously on the computer? Because for all I know, half your status updates are absolute bullshit anyway, because I can't call you on it because you don't have a life and you don't have any friends and you're not in a relationship and you don't work and you don't do physical activities because you're living your life through this network. And again, you know, I could go on forever about this. It's overkill. I don't care that much about you to begin with. I don't care who you are. I really don't care who you are. I don't need an update on what's going on in your life every 5 minutes.
Everybody reference needs to episode 134.
But, you know, if you want to talk to somebody, pick up your phone and give them a call. Or hop in your car and drive over and go see them. Instead, people are sharing things, and in some cases, they're targeted to such a narrow, narrow audience, but you feel you have to proclaim it to the world. And I got to bring up Kyle, not to pick on him, but he's just a really good example, because Kyle is somebody who has some very interesting things to share. He'll post some topics or some links that I find, you know, really, really, really interesting, and I'm glad he put them up there. Sometimes it makes my day. But that's after filtering through all the other, you know, I said it before, I'm getting on my flight to go to such and such con. Oh, flight's delayed for such and such a con. Back on my flight for such and such a con. Just landed at the airport for such and such a con. open the ceremony starts in 90 minutes with such and such a car. I don't care. I can figure this shit out. I can go to their website, look at their schedule of events. Oh, okay, Kyle's at open ceremonies right now, but I won't call him. I don't need this minute to minute. It's way too much, and I don't like having to filter through that. The technology isn't smart enough to say, here's a relative link for you that you might be interested in, and we're going to filter out, like, spam the rest of the stuff. And if the Facebook gods are listening to my rant now, you know, do that. Develop a spam filter for Facebook. I would totally – I'd pay to use Facebook if you could develop a spam filter.
But what is relatively spam? That's the problem. I mean, that's what the hide button is for you to essentially mark.
Well, see, this is what I'm
jeweled to spam.
This is what I'm looking at. How does Google know what spam when it filters your email? There's certain parameters or whatever. And Facebook, you know, like all other media, it's following you. It's storing cookies on your computer and it's logging your keystrokes and whatever. It should be able to, at some point, know what's relative and irrelative. I don't know. When you do a search, sometimes it has relative links. You know, if you go to Amazon, you kind of have a customers who bought this also bought this. So I don't think it's like too far-fetched to say you could at least follow my patterns of what I find interesting, what I find disinteresting, and develop a filter on that. Of course, it's being Facebook, people are going to bitch regardless. But people like me, you save me a lot of trouble. I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah. So what else have we got? What was the iPad tweet that enraged Steve Jobs? I really do love this story. There was inevitably some cultural friction when Apple's secretive CEO took his iPad around to New York's professionally indiscreet media. Exhibit A is a single tweet from a Wall Street Journal editor, which purportedly made Steve Jobs go ballistic. The tweet says, "This tweet is sent from an iPad. Does it look cool?" The Journal's online executive editor, Alan Murray, quickly deleted the February 4th tweet, which it is now obvious was issued during the Apple CEO Jobs show and tell with select journal staff. A tipster told us the deletion ultimately traces back to a furious Jobs. We asked Murray for comment, and he wrote back, "I would love to talk about this, but I can't." In a later email, he added, "I will say that Apple's general paranoia about news coverage is truly extraordinary, but that's not telling you anything you didn't already know." Indeed, Apple is notoriously tight-lipped as a company, particularly under Jobs, and is constantly trying to control the flow of news about its products. Apple sued a teenage blogger who published scoops about unreleased products. It lied about Jobs' health problems. Jobs called a New York Times columnist a slime bucket for writing about said health problems. And an employee of key Apple contractor Foxconn had his apartment illegally searched after losing an iPhone prototype, and he later committed suicide with intense pressure from his employer. If Jobs did give Murray a tongue-lashing, his withering verbal abuse is infamous. The editor can console himself with the knowledge that this is an especially touchy time of year for the paranoid Jobs, and not just because of the pressures of shepherding and unveiling a new product. At Jobs' meeting at the Times, the CEO was mostly on point, painting a utopian picture of a happy future awash in iPads. But at the juncture in the meeting, we hear he took a detour, telling an assembled newspaper staff that he gets tons of hate mail from people whenever he launches a new product, people who have never even used it, including angry Apple fans, in quotes. Jobs reportedly described the mail as really nasty stuff, things like fuck you and your family. It sounds like Jobs has been fighting this sort of backlash his whole career, judging from a 1994 Rolling Stone interview in which he said, "I've always been attracted to the more revolutionary changes. I don't know why, probably because they're harder. They're much more stressful emotionally. And you usually go through a period where everybody tells you you've completely failed." Of course, fuck your family sounds less like fanboys than regretful stock speculators. That's the sort of e-note to go ballistic over. Yeah. Release a really cheap tablet PC called the iPad for $500, piss everybody off with the name, and oh yeah, don't add stylus support. Yeah, you're going to have a whole bunch of fans.
Again, weird, wild west activity going on. The internet is so wonderful in so many ways because never before have companies been held to such a high degree of accountability. We've talked about stories of Comcast sending customers rebates or sending up free packages for a certain duration of time because they were truly passionate about their dislike for Comcast. And this is a way of smoothing things over with their customers. But if you screw up a highly anticipated product at launch and you have an incredibly rabid fan base, the internet isn't your best friend anymore, because my Twitter and my MySpace and my Facebook and my blogs and my new Google service are proclaiming to the world, I am pissed off at Apple because they did something incredibly ridiculous. And it snowballs, and it turns into this tremendous, almost like the anonymous type sweep up and fervor in the community, and everybody gets behind it. And the non-fanboys, people like me, I got no problem just jumping in and talking shit with the rest of the people. You know, iPad, insert, you know, feminine hygiene product joke here. It can have this tremendous backlash. But at the end of the day, you're still going to see people buying this thing. It really doesn't matter. Does Apple really care about the flack it's getting over this product? No, not really. Because even their shittiest selling devices are still making them hundreds of millions of dollars a year. You're going to have enough people that are going to come together and buy this thing, particularly before the holiday season, if only out of ignorance. But you're going to see this thing fly off the shelf. And probably by this time next year, when they're on version 3 of it, you'll probably hear people speaking this praise. You'll probably be people heralding it like the iPhone and the iPod. I don't know. But I don't think Jobs or anybody's too worried. Do you think Jobs really cares when somebody throws a jab at him? You know? Do you think movie stars care when they get bad press about their movies?
Well, he's really like George Lucas in that sense, where it's like, you're totally ruining the tablet market. Like, I don't care.
I think that's an incredible parallel to make. It couldn't be more true. If George Lucas is the bane for ruining our childhood, then Steve Jobs is certainly, you know, the guy you're going to lambast over destroying your techie geekiness. Apple, for some reason, got so entrenched in geek culture that everything they have to do has to turn to gold. Because if they misfire, it's the wrath. But I think the fanboyism in them is strong enough where they're going to talk shit all the way up to the counter at the Apple store to buy it. You know, this kind of hypocrisy there. I think Jobs is sleeping, you know, just fine at night with his pillowcase stuffed with $1 million bills. I'm sure he goes to sleep with a big smile on his face. I don't think he's losing any sleep or missing any meals because people are saying, oh, you guys suck and I'm going to kill your family. He's like, yeah, right. Get past my $3 billion security system first. My sharks with lasers and my boat.
Yeah, I knew it was going there. It's like, yeah, get past my $3 billion security. I've got sharks with lasers, robot dogs. They're eye dogs.
He's got the chicken walker from the RoboCop movie.
Oh, yeah, the Ed 209. Identify yourself.
Seriously, when your company's bringing in six $1 million quarterly from iTunes, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous money. I mean, the average person can't wrap their brain around that, just how Apple is just this money vacuum for some reason. So it doesn't matter. They don't care. It's not going to change a thing. You're still going to buy a new iMac and you're still going to buy a new iPhone and you're still going to, you know, support them to the end. Doesn't matter if they misfire, because you're going to buy the misfire too. It's $500. Fuckers knew what they were doing. We're releasing a substandard product at a kind of impulse purchase price.
Oh, yeah. That's how cults work.
You know. So I guess my anonymous analogy earlier was kind of appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, this story just kind of struck me as hilarious because I read it and it's like, oh, really? Because earlier in the week, there was a story about Steve Jobs had like this pep talk with key Apple staff essentially saying that like Google is full of shit and fuck them. And I'm just kind of sitting here like, whoa, dude, slow down. Because, you know, like a lot of writers are referring to them as frenemies, Apple and Google, both working towards the same goal, but Google's just better at it.
That's really good. I applaud that. I love the fact that the PS3 has gotten a lot of notice, especially since the price drop, because it encourages competition with Microsoft and the 360. So I love that Apple and Google can't get along, because it's going to fuel that fire. And we're starting to see a lot of like really cool results from that. Apple's doing really well with the iPhone, and Google has like 16 devices on the market. Yeah, I'm kind of overblowing things, but that's where it's going to be like by spring, because Android is just a huge developing open source thing. So Yeah, I alluded to it a while ago about the artist from EVE Records, being able to have them up on Amazon, and how that's awesome because that's your default music buying thing app on the Android phones. And the more Android phones that are out there, the more hands you're putting that in. It's direct competition at Apple. Apple's really got to put up or shut up. They have to look at not only what they're doing with the iPhone, they have to look at the market that's carrying it. You know, they're already saying, this year, no longer exclusive to AT&T because that's really not fair. You've seen corporations go down for that, like Microsoft, because there's certain rules and regulations you have to follow as a business. When you can only get this one product and this one service, it's kind of an issue there. So it's already forcing a lot of friendly competition, and you need it. So otherwise, it would be a stagnant market, and everybody would just have an iPhone, and how much fun would that be?
Right. So I think that that's kind of a good enough upbeat that we can end the show on.
I think so.
Yeah, because I think that, like, it's a short show, but it's to the point as a show. I mean, this is probably the shortest show that we've ever done together, but...
It's only really 5 minutes off from being a full-length app, so not a big deal.
Yeah, but we have standards, damn it. Oh, well, this is the Kyle Caliber show. That's what I'll call it. That's how I'll justify this.
Yay.
Kyle. Hi, my name is Kyle Hebert.
I'm sorry you couldn't be here tonight, Kyle.
Yes, we miss you. I miss the ability to do other things while the show is going on. Come back to us, Kyle.
Because Steve's making him do stuff against his will when the show's over. Now leave it to your imagination, kids.
Even worse at Tech... Like, the road to Techo is paved with butt-fucking.
It's only, you know, funny because it's true.
Yeah, sadly. Thanks to everyone who showed up tonight. Normally Kyle would read off the names, but I'm not gonna, just because I'm obviously not very good at reading tonight. But just a couple of people. Evan, Kamina, Fanto, Queen Lol, wielding the Ban Hammer of Justice.
Hammer.
Kiba Kesticles, another regular. Nate the Great One, another regular. Miss November, you, Steve, Ranimus, Saint Angel, and Sam, amongst other people who were so happy that you showed up despite the fact that Kyle's not here. So, is there anything that we should go out on, Steve, other than, you know, the road is paved with the surprise butt sex?
The road is paved with surprise and sometimes not so surprise butt sex.
Oh, yeah. So, listen close to the credits as Mariana's going to tell you exactly how it is that you can get in touch with the Big Bald Broadcast. But until next time, I am Mark Swint.
And this is Otherworld Steve.
See ya.
Check out the BigBaldBroadcast.com, the central hub for all the geeky news that you can use. There you can listen to new episodes, go back through the archives, and view our latest Twitter news. You can send your mail and MP3 comments to mail@thebigbaldbroadcast.com. Subscribe now via iTunes, Zoom Marketplace, or your favorite RSS aggregator to have episodes downloaded automatically. Donations are graciously accepted and appreciated. Music provided by DJ Unicron and Zero Reynolds.